Now, living with BetterCap, there's a few tips and tricks. Sometimes it's a little extra information, like if you're running BetterCap and machines come and go, you don't really necessarily want to hear about the machine left. So you could say events.ignore endpoint.lost, and it's not going to show you, you know, things that are no longer interesting to you. You know, we have that option. We can look at stuff. We can do some introspection with a get command, and inside in this example, get HTTP star to show us some of the potential commands. As I was saying, I like to use EtherCap because it's very surgical. It's written in C. It's very fast. If I'm doing simple things, I still like that. BetterCap I like for a lot of the features it does. It's such a quickly changing target though. As he adds new features, you know, I don't always want to use BetterCap. Again, I've been in a situation where a VPN is involved and BetterCap won't work because of the ARP proxying that happens over a VPN tunnel. Another VPN bridge type of situations, this would also be a problem because now I've become more than just my two victims I'm concerned with. And maybe the traffic doesn't actually get to the other side of a tunnel or a bridge. So I like to stop and think about it when I get to that point and say, what am I trying to accomplish here? All right, I need to become in the middle and I need to do something with the traffic of interest to me. So I could do something like what we show here using ARP spoof from the Doug song, or I use escapee script to actually poison and become in the middle. Once I'm doing that, then what I could do is use something like a man in the middle proxy. Literally, it's called MITM proxy. It's a project that has lots of great tampering features. But it doesn't do the, you know, poisoning. It doesn't become in the middle. It's just once you're in the middle, it has a lot of features for you to use. So if I do that and I also force all of the traffic from port 80 into it with this IP tables command, then I can do something like our EtherCap filter replacement. We can replace anything. In this final line of today's example on this page, we can say, you know, replace anything in a query. That's what the Q, the tilde Q in the command line option means. And then the match would be the thing we're matching against. And then what do we want to replace it with would be the next section between the colon delimiters. This is MITM dump. It's basically a MITM proxy is the tool, but MITM dump basically says, I don't care about the text interface. I'm going to treat it like TCP dump. I just want to run against either packet captures or live traffic. So also notice too, we didn't do the port 80 source of destination. This just says Q for request. So an HTTP request is going to be where it's going to look. So it's pretty simple syntax. If you would like to do other things, you can, you know, hijack the response and the S, and you can do many other things. Of course, you can try reading the man page if you have it, or the usage by doing MITM dump or MITM proxy minus H, it should be able to see some usage of the command line options. So again, I find myself actually moving more towards this MITM proxy tool, actively developed, written in Python, lots of great features being added all the time. So I'm starting to use it more often. The primary reason that we would choose a custom hijack, like using something like MITM proxy or any other tool that does something, just any reason we might pick to use something besides EtherCap or BetterCap or some tool that we've already covered, we tend to want to do something more tailored. So adjusting it to get a better, more precise placement of being in the middle, perhaps, or maybe under certain conditions we can have the tool behave a little differently. Either way, it's the easiest way for us to manipulate if we stop and think about exactly what we would like to accomplish. So that's why I like using MITM proxy or MITM dump, that command line version, to do the actual work of what we want to do while in the middle, but do some extra custom hijacking with something like escapee script. This HTTP hijack script code snippet I'm showing you here on slide 140. We have a couple of things we're showing. Basically a simple surgical man in the middle of ARP poisoning using escapee. You don't have to look at this from a, I don't know how to use Scapy perspective. It's pretty easy to read as it is. We have two targets coming in, variable two and variable one. The idea that these victim variables into the function name defined is we're going to tell one victim that its IP address belongs to the hardware address, and vice versa. Basically placing ourselves in the middle with a classic ARP spoofing, but only targeting those two machines, much like how EtherCAP does the grouping, but without all the other things EtherCAP is doing. Also, too, we might want to pick this technique specifically because BetterCAP, which would give us a lot of power in while in the middle, with this custom situation, though, we're not sending out an ARP broadcast, which BetterCAP does, and requires a gateway being involved. That's all we're really seeing, is we're telling victim one that we're victim two's IP address on this hardware address, and same thing the other direction, placing ourselves directly in the middle of exactly two targets. Now, when we run this particular script that I made just for this course, you can view the script and see the rest of it. May make a little more sense after we've covered the Scapy and Python content in 660.3, where we get more in depth. It's still a simple enough to read script. You can see what we're doing if you'd like. You will use this later when you perform the exercise. Basically, it'll ask you which interface. If you were in person, you can use ETA 0. If you are bridged from your Kali VM, that makes sense to the network. But if you're using the TAP 0 interface over the VPN, you would enter the TAP 0 under the first prompt for the desired interface. Then place your victim IP address, which is whatever your Windows 10 VM is going to be, and also the server. In this example, is victim 2. So when the time comes, you'll be placing yourself in the middle of these two IP addresses by using my HTTP hijack script, which if you read the source, will also include a port redirection to force traffic into our MITM transparent proxy. Now, there's still a little bit left. The script doesn't do everything for you. This script basically does the man-in-the-middling itself, and we use the MITM dump or the MITM proxy command separately to do the actual work of what it is we're going to do while in the middle. So the ARP poisoning, we're doing the HTTP hijack and sending it to a different port. Then we can do something like use the sample script for SSL strip that comes with the examples. We've actually symbolically linked that to your lab day one directory from the examples bundled with MITM proxy. You just have to specify that mode transparent command line option and then the script with that minus S option for the SSL stripped example. You may want to go in and find yourself adding to that script. There is some case sensitive options in there that you may have to manipulate, as I found I've had to do in the future. It will work for our exercise as we have it here. With this command running, again, transparent proxy mode is basically assuming that the browser, our victim browser, isn't going to know it's talking to a proxy. That's why we make it transparent. It's not going to give us proxy commands. It's going to give us commands as if we were actually the web server. We have to use transparent mode here. Our next section for today is on routing the attacks. So far, what have we done? We've done accessing the network, you know, bypassing the captive portal was the scenario we looked at mostly. That gave us a better foothold on the network. And then in manipulating the network, we were doing man in the middle and manipulating the protocol that was getting transported over. HTTP, port 80, TCP is what we've been doing so far. Let's talk for a moment about what we can do as far as manipulating and networks when it comes to the router part of the equation. So depending upon how things are implemented, we might be able to attack differently. Here we have HSRP, the Hot Standby Router Protocol. This was something Cisco published. It's not, it's still proprietary in that Cisco developed it, but it has been published. So you can communicate with Cisco devices that follow this protocol. The idea is you'd have a pool of routers and they would be ready to assume the identity of a virtual router as needed. So you've got these routers already running, primary and secondary, as we've shown in this image. The primary one's the one actively doing the routing, and the secondary one's just waiting for the primary one to not work anymore, and then it will pick up where it left off. The mechanism actually works because there's a virtual IP, not just the actual IP of the routers, but there's a virtual IP that they both share. The idea is you would send traffic for the workstation would always send to the virtual IP. We show it here as 10.10.10.254. That virtual IP, regardless of which router is actually routing, would do the routing job, any traffic sent to that IP address. Also too, the ARP mechanisms for this is used with a group ID. Basically, the idea setting that group ID is you should have different groups of routers, not just one possibility when you leave the network. This is send out multicast hello messages using UDP port 1985. The idea, again, is if that hello message stops seeing traffic, if the router stops seeing traffic from the hello messages, we will know as the lower priority router that we should start sending the traffic. By default, HSRP does use the password of Cisco, all lowercase, as the password. It's quite silly. Even if it was not a silly default, it is in clear text. So anytime you see that hello message, you see in clear text that password. So if you're an attacker and you see an HSRP broadcast, multicast, you would see that and be able to take advantage of it. How would we take advantage of it? So far, we've only been talking about how it actually works. Let's attack it. With that authentication key that we've collected, we can become in the middle. The idea is we would send out a hello message with a more important priority, and then the legitimate primary router would relinquish that MAC for our router group, our HSRP group, and we would then have all the traffic. We would just start participating in the pool with a higher priority. The question really is, I guess, then how does it distinguish priority? Well, if I change that MAC address to the right HSRP group, and then I become in the middle, it actually uses the priority field in the protocol. There's a special priority field that actually has it. The ties are actually determined by my real MAC address. So, I'd say real, I can fake that. And it's quite easy then, if you are able to see the traffic, to become in the middle. And therefore, we man in the middle did just via injecting routes. The question really is, I guess, what do we inject with far as routes? We would have to, you know, have a network destination matching something we were actually looking for. Here's Yersinia attacking HSRP. You see some of the traffic, and we start attacking it. We have become the active router just by a broadcast, and then try to pretend to be one of the other routers to man the middle, the legitimate routers to become in the middle, which would man the middle of the traffic passing through that router. VRRP is the standards-based replacement. So instead of Cisco's HSRP, we can have an more of an open platform here. Similar mechanisms, though. We have the same idea of a virtual MAC and a different multicast group. It's the same idea, though. It doesn't do a UDP protocol. It does do it over an IP protocol 112. It does have that priority field. The idea is the largest priority is the network master, and you just have to beat that out. If there is a tie break, you can definitely have the more greater IP address is the tie on the VRRP. Since there's no authentication or integrity checks, it's actually easier to exploit if you have the visibility, you've seen it in the first place, you know it's there, and if you have a tool that works with it. Unfortunately, Yersinia does not, you know, identifies VRRP, it does not have an attack built in. It wouldn't be hard to port it to there, but Yersinia is quite old, and so we usually see it involved in newer tools. Loki is one of these newer network attack tools we have. Don't confuse Loki with other Loki tools. I can think of six different Loki named tools when it comes to cybersecurity. The one we're looking for is attacking layer three protocols mostly. It is a Python tool, has graphical, has a lot of great functionality. It definitely has more attack functionality than Yersinia. There is a Windows port of it that works quite well. Surprisingly to me, it was anyway, because there's so much different networking activity going on. There is, as far as like pure power limitations, because of the writing raw packets depending upon your version of Windows, you may have a hard time with being able to do that quickly, but it is still surprisingly useful on Windows. Loki looks a little like this. We see our graphical dialog. The first thing you'll need to do when attacking with Loki is you click on the gears. In step one, we click on the gears, and then we can click on this hot standby tab, and you see another tab for VRRP, not HSRP, but VRRP. And you can see things. The taken is the primary one. The secondary one we saw, so it's under scene. We can just get IP and become one of the router that is the master router in the VRRP group. Generally, you can deal with this on a larger level by asking yourself, what are routers supposed to be doing? Well, routers exchange route tables besides actually doing the routing of traffic. They exchange route tables between the routers. The risk happens for route injection is not when a router does its job and tells other routers that it knows a route, but when a workstation starts participating because it sees, wait a minute, I'm seeing route broadcasts. That must mean I can participate as a router. There's no routing filtering of routing propagation algorithms here. Okay. They are useful to have those things, but not for the workstations. It should be between routers only. Now, one option we have is we could actually use a router, and this has been documented as happened a few different times over the years, where a peered router accidentally assumes it can handle more traffic than it was supposed to, and traffic is diverted over it. So we've seen a few, you know, seemingly coincidental attacks that way, where it wasn't intended, at least it was claimed it wasn't intended, it was an accident, the traffic was sent, but those are by routers that already trusted each other. I could, as an attacker, bring my own router to the equation, and now I can, if I can peer with existing routers, I might be able to have a way to influence the routing decisions of the other routers. Generally speaking, with OSPF, one of the values in it is it has these link state tables. And the idea is the table's going to store any advertisements it gets, link state advertisements, from nearby routers. And then it will say, I know exactly where to forward this router over here told me he is directly connected to that network. And that happens to be the one you're looking to deliver this packet to. So I can do that. All right, so that's a little bit about how OSPF works. It does basically have the idea that the more specific the route, the better. There's also different ways to judge the weighting of the routes, which ones should take priority. But link state advertisements in OSPF give us much more flexibility to define what the best option is. In classic routing, like with the RIP routing protocol, RIP, it is very simple. It just counts the number of hops. And if it's more hops, it is shunned, and preference is given to routers with less hops. In OSPF, we can better account for the fact that some connections might be more expensive than others and divert traffic to the more cheaper option, not the fastest option. So as these messages, these advertisements, are collected from routers, a router who receives those advertisements is going to basically have a nice table. These LSA messages inside of a table are going to be cross-referenced anytime it needs to decide where to route a packet. OSPF does use a backbone area. It's just zero. And the idea of that is the more specific of a route you give, the higher priority it naturally has. So if we get closer to, I have a route for one host, or I have a route for a subnet of only four machines, you know, those are better optimizations than trying to forward something to something larger that also matches. So the backbone area being just zero effectively, is within how that mapping gets realized. That if I want to not be everything on the internet, start routing it to a specific IP address, I will be very precise. This routing fail screenshot, we can see some OSPF traffic at the same point as we see Windows Network NetBIOS name broadcast, actually. And that's a bad thing, right? We see that that's bad, that it even exists, the hello packet exists. And if we drill into that, we see auth type of null. That's even worse. That's a great candidate for an attack. So when we want to enumerate this and actually find these routers, if we are participating as a neighbor, we could actually inject a more specific route to a route that already has to redirect traffic coming from that source, all right? Basically, we have to deal with, if there is an MD5 authentication challenge response, we have to accommodate that. But then we can pair with the router. Once we're pairing with the router, then the OSPF link states can be exchanged. And we can see that with X start, exchange, loading, and full. It means we're fully peered and fully up to date and ready to inject routes. Using the same Loki tool we mentioned with the VRRP, we can conduct our OSPF route injection attacks. So first, of course, we have to be on the right network adapter, and that's our step one. Step two, we click on the routing tab and the OSPF sub tab, and then we get a view something like this, depending upon what routes Loki is able to see. The highlighted line here of 192.168.100.20 does say that it's already fully peered and connected, and no auth type. So this is an easy way for us to attack by injecting something. Well, what would we do? First, again, we've already pulled it up in Loki. Once we are on the one we're of interest to, we could go down here to this connection tab in the bottom left, down here in the bottom left. I mean, this connection tab, and area zero is the largest area. The auth type, as you see, is none, right? See, auth type of none. There was none up here in Wireshark output. We don't have to change anything. Now, if we did have to change the auth type to something, we would also want to change the key to whichever key it claimed it was using, key number one, key number two, key number three, whichever key it is. We want this ID to be the same. Then we would place in the key field that key, and we could actually take advantage of that. So let's look at our OSPF MD5 authentication situation. I will walk through the lecture portion here. The OSPF MD5 auth, how would we see that? We see Wireshark or TCP dump OSPF traffic. Maybe we saw it with EtherCAP. That actually did show up earlier when we were looking at EtherCAP. Once it's there, we can decide to run Loki and, looking at the OSPF tab, wait for it to populate with OSPF-related traffic to identify those routers. Then we select the router we want, and we can click on Crack PW. And you see this cracking tab in the lower bottom left. We see this, and the idea here is we can give it a word list, dictionary list, and have it do guesses against that. I will hesitate. I want to explain here, brute force is an option, although realistically you never use it. It might seem like a good idea to check that box, but what happens is when it's cracking this, it'll actually try to crack the brute force password first, and then it will try the dictionary, which isn't what most of us intend. The brute force we usually only would like to do if there's no success in cracking from a dictionary list. So don't check that field, all right? Don't check the brute force field. Leave it the way it was. Then once it cracks this password, which depending upon how hard it is, it might take long, might take not much time at all, from that dictionary, again, it depends on how good the dictionary is for what the password is. Then up here in the off tab, you see it was already set to crypt, but in the crack tab, it will place in there what it actually cracked for you. Here we have alternating case of the word secret. That all can happen when you crack the password using Loki for an OSPF MD5 cracking attack. Now to attack a router, we do have a few options. We mentioned Loki was a great attack tool for this, and that would work, but it doesn't necessarily always the best tool. Loki is, again, a tool. There might be better options. You might, in production, worry about using a tool designed to attack and not know how good it is at holding up when it comes to a production router and traffic that might be in play if it is a man-in-the-middle situation. So you may want to just use a real router. There's nothing that precludes bringing in a Cisco router and maliciously managing it as the attacker. You know, there is an option of using a virtual machine. Cisco has some of those available for download, and you may want to make your own. I find myself doing a combination of these things. I often have virtual machine-based routing because it's easy to pause and keep it clean and not have logs from other engagements and other complications. You could, again, if you're good at managing a device by itself, just use that router. One tool that may come in handy, there are others too, but Dynamips. It uses the Cisco iOS firmware to boot into a virtual machine. You just need to have a license that lets you get that. Basically, you can download from Cisco's customer portal the updated firmware or a backdate firmware for the device that you've registered that you own, and that gives you access to that if you have the license. Now with Dynamips running the router, you can use DynaGen to kind of manage it. It generates new configurations or startup and some other things. Our next module is IPv6 for penetration testers. So, quick review, we access the network, bypass the captive portal. Manipulating the network, man-in-the-middling to increase our attack surface and actually expose protocols embedded in the traffic. Routing attacks, we can also place ourselves in the middle by routing traffic through us by doing route-like attacks. Well, with IPv6, we might be able to use that to become in the middle if we understand IPv6 clearly. But another thing I like to think about with IPv6 is alternative to IPv4. Like, often I find that as a result of an assessment, an IP version 4 rule has been implemented to block certain kinds of traffic. And I often find that is also not the case in IPv6, that if the tool didn't support it as obviously, maybe a special command line option had to be used to do IPv6, or that there's just an assumption. And we only use that machine for its IPv4 address. We forget that Windows ships with IPv6 and Linux and everything else running IPv6 by default, but we're not managing it. There might be a way to circumvent firewall rules by using IPv6. So that's one reason we talk about it here today. If we're really clever too, we can use IPv6 to become in the middle, not just to circumvent a firewall rule. Let's dive into IPv6 penetration testing. Historically, IPv4 is simpler for pen testers to use. So you could argue that IPv6 is more complex. That's a good thing for an attacker if you think about it, right? Complexities often mean that it's not managed correctly, so more attack surface for the attacker. We've seen organizations attempt and slowly try to adopt IPv6. Maybe they didn't even really try yet, and they only started to. Often, again, thinking that you don't have IPv6 is usually a bad idea. Like, I don't need to test IPv6 because we use IPv4. Your machines are already set up to do IPv6. They're just doing it unmanaged. we need to be able to test that out as an attacker. So let's talk about some basics with IPv6. In IPv4, we have effectively a 20-byte header, and we have IP options after that header that let us do, you know, fancy creative things with IP, the Internet Protocol. In IPv6, the concept is much more complex here because, well, with IPv6, instead of having IPv6 packet options, we have extra headers that have new features. So our IPv6 header that we're talking about has a much larger address. I mean, we've got more number of bytes used for the address, both for source and destination. We have a few things that are similar to our IPv6 besides the version. We have a hop limit, which is basically the TTL of IPv4. It's just we stopped talking about it with relative to time. It's just the number of routers it can go through before it needs to be discarded. There's a few other things like the flow and some other stuff that we're not going to be able to take advantage of so much as an attacker, but it's important to know that they're there. IPv6 addresses can be quite personalized, kind of like how in like some places you can have personalized license plates for your vehicles, where you can suggest to whatever motor authority you have. Like, I live in the state of California in the U.S., and our California Department of Motor Vehicles has a mechanism for me to pick a license plate that, as long as it's not violating the standards, I can pick, for a fee, of course, what I have as my address. Well, you can do that with IPv6 as well, a vanity address. Like Facebook has, they spell out Facebook in leet-speak inside of the address. There's a lot of potential for creativity when you have the ability to store so many, well, not just store, but to have so many different addresses that represent an endpoint. We don't have the old dotted decimal. This is hexadecimal. We have those four octets in IPv4, right? Well, here we have 16-bit fields, hex quad, separated by colons. Leading zeros are optional, just like most numbers. You know, you don't always put those leading zeros in front of a number. And then patterns of zeros can be truncated with just two colons. But we can only do that once in the address. The idea is we still have to have, the address has to be only expandable to one kind of an address, all right? So we can only collapse one group of zeros. And we can collapse either group in this first example that we have, but we can only do one of them. Since we can remove the leading zeros first in each group, that's what we've done on the second line here. And then the final line, we have the first leading group of zeros removed, because that saves us the most for shorthand. So we have FE80 colon colon, and if you expand it out, those are all going to be zeros. That way it always goes back to a complete address. All right, so a few notations about that. And somebody was asking me once about why IPv4 didn't do it, what a great idea it was. And IPv4 actually does do the zero thing, if you weren't familiar. Many of us have pinged 127.0.0.1 as IPv4 just to test out ping output, really, because how often can you not ping yourself? But you could just use 127.1, and that works. There's even a Cloudflare's DNS provider. They have a 1.1.1.1 DNS server, but they also have a 1.0.0.1. And in fact, you can truncate that to 1.1. So yes, you can use a DNS server of 1.1 in most situations. Of course, there may be applications that don't follow that protocol, but it's really a shorthand of the actual address. So there's different families of IPv6 addresses. Under IPv6 addressing, we can have unicast, which is one-to-one. We could have a globally unique address, a site local or a link local address. So a global address, of course, like the name sounds, means that it is exclusively to you. Globally, you will have that address, no matter where you're at. The site local address is much like our RFC 1918, where we have a private address, but somewhere else in the world, somebody might have that same private address. And the link local is even more specific, exactly like our one subnet, RFC19, our link local, only for that. Now, we also have the concept that was unicast, you know, point to point. We have anycast, which is one to nearest. Like, hey, I need a google.com web server. Give me the nearest google.com. And then we have multicast, which can mean I want to send a broadcast to all of google.com or something. That's our multicast. We don't really have the idea of a broadcast where it's everything. But multicast still serves the same purpose, where we can send to more than one machine and get the job done. There are reserved address prefixes for us. For example, FE80 is our link local. That's the closest thing, again, to our RFC 1918, because it is our class C. Now, if we use multiple RFC 1918s, that's the site local. Again, the closest model to that. But a link local would just be one of those RFC 1918 networks. And then we have a few other options, of course, multicast FF00 and a few other things. Now, we also have this last one I'd like to highlight, too, because I've seen people get confused about this. There were some issues we've had with IPv4 and documentation where I remember one time there was a university that had an issue because they were assigned an IP address that was previously reserved, but the NMAP authors had used it as an example. It was reserved, so no one really thought too much about using that as an example in the paperwork, in the manual documentation of NMAP. And when people blindly copy and paste what they saw in documentation, once those addresses were in use and no longer reserved, they were getting a lot of NMAP-related traffic, and it really, really broke down. So in IPv6, this 2001:DB8:32 is documentation. So when you are doing something like this, where we're saying hypothetically, this is what an IPv6 address looks like, it's used only for reference. It's not an actual, it's reserved for reference. It's not an actual address that's usable. At least it should not be used. There are a few different ways. Again, like I said, you can have vanity addresses, depending upon the network identifiers. But the automatic interface addressing that we show here, EUI64, is one way that the concept of our hardware MAC address maps to an IPv6 address. I would also like to point out that another comment people make is, wow, this means that since IPv6 doesn't have ARP because the MAC address is part of the address, that there's no more ARP spoofing. And technically that's correct. IPv6 is one way to prevent ARP spoofing. But that's pretty silly because it's just what you're calling the address. Since the MAC address is still in the actual IP address, yes, we don't have ARP poisoning anymore. We have IPv6 poisoning. It's the same idea. So if somebody does say that they moved to IPv6 to prevent ARP poisoning, yes, that's technically correct, but that's also a very silly statement to make because it's just poisoning now. It's not ARP poisoning. But in this example, this MAC address, in order to put that in, it's actually split in half and FFFE is inserted in the middle. We preference 02 at the beginning here. To give us the address we're looking at, and that is the automatic stateless auto-config based off of your vendor, OEM vendor-supplied MAC address, how you get your unique auto-config. And you can always look at that too, right? Like, it's an automatic configuration. Let me continue. Continuing on IPv6, the automatic things that you see here, the stateless auto-config, you should be thinking in your mind, anytime you see something convenient, it's automatic. Well, how can I manipulate that as an attacker? It's not something the defender has to do. It's a convenience for people to plug in and have IPv6 just work. So which ones of these features can I manipulate is an important concept going forward. Let's look at how Linux does IPv6 interface configuration. Depending upon the vintage of Linux, you might have to force it to load an IPv6 kernel module with the mod probe command. But most newer Linuxes already have that running. It's only for maybe specialized embedded devices that have it removed for trying to squeeze memory performance out of a small embedded device, maybe, or an older device that doesn't have it. You would try to load it. To configure it by hand, you can use the ifconfig command. You can use ipaddr command as well, but here we are adding an inet6 add an address fc00660 and so on. We're adding that in, providing a subnet mask with the /64. Now, if we look at that setting, it does show us that that's, notice the scope is link. It's a link local on the FE80, but the global, we just hard-coded an address, so that's globally unique. And then, of course, we can delete it with a del command if for some reason we want to do that. We have those kind of capabilities. So for attacking, what are our opportunities for attacking IPv6? IPv6 attacks can be local to the LAN or, you know, some combination of remote. As I was saying, automatic is a convenient thing and often able to be abused. Okay. Sometimes there's some misconfiguration. We have a host that listens on an IP address and we only want to allow certain IP addresses to connect to that service. We can whitelist those. But if somebody's blacklisted IPv4 but forgotten about IPv6, we might be able to get around those blocking rules. We definitely need to have that access and be part of the network, whatever network that is. And sometimes I might be able to do some of this stuff remotely. But mostly we'll be talking about the close by ones. First, let's look at local IPv6 device enumeration. To scan, we could use a ping 6 and send out a multicast to a link local address, or ping 6, C5, a count of 5, to FF02:1 on ETH0. That percent notation is part of how we use it with ping 6. We can also use the IP-6 command for the version 6 stuff and look for neighbors. That's what we're seeing with the nay command. We might write our own tools to do some of these things, but the base tools are pretty common here. We have detect new IP6 on ETH0. This is what's happening with the duplicate address detection. The idea is when a machine connects with IPv6 to a network, it can keep an eye out for new addresses that are traffic that happens to be an address it has. So if we are running detect new IPv6 on an adapter, every time there's a new IPv6, we could scan it or do something with a custom script with this tool. As it sees a new machine, it can try to interact with it. It's again like a collision detection mechanism, the duplicate address detection, DAD. Connect to it, and then a machine broadcasts, kind of like ARP, hey, I'm at this address, that's what it's doing, and then we can give it something once it says that to us. Next, we'll look at scanning the IPv6 hosts. Just like normal IPv4, we can scan. In Nmap, we use a -6, and we can still have similar commands. With Nmap, though, you can't do large-scale scanning. It's just too much. You have to do some breakdown of the addresses, right? Either a specific address, or we can do a CIDR range. We can't do like every combination of every multicast because it's just too much. But we can still get our normal one-to-one scanning still. As we were saying before, neighbor impersonation is one possibility. Since IPv6 doesn't use ARP, it uses neighbor discovery, right? Here we have in step one here, node A sends out a neighbor solicitation. It says, hey, who are my neighbors? I need to talk to B. B says, hey, I'm here. This is me. This is my physical address. And now node A, can in this second half of the chart on the right here, says on ICMP v6 neighbor solicitation. Say, everyone tell me where you're at so I know what's on my network. B returns a neighbor advertisement to A, and the attacker actually sends out his own with an override flag. So the idea here is, again, that the ability is necessary for things like load balancers on the network to override and to do these ARP broadcasts unauthenticated, to actually send out an announcement that I'm at this address. So with Node B, the idea here is it's looking at this, and even though it's got cached an original legitimate one, if that override flag is set, it's going to override whatever it already knew. So an attacker could just walk in and turn on the I'm an attacker flag, basically, and override it. It was argued that during the development of the standard, this was necessary so that a fault-tolerant situation, when Node comes back up, it could say, no, I'm back, come back to me legitimately, and not wait for things to expire out of the cache. That was the override flag's intent. But it does seem a lot like we've just designed something to attack, because that would be definitely what an attacker would be interested in doing. IPv6 neighbor impersonation. So, couple of ways this might happen. We'll be looking at the one with the Parasite 6 tool from the Hacker's Choice. The auto configuration that happens for the link local addresses, the idea is we can create a two-way man in the middle between two local machines with unsolicited neighbor advertisements with an override flag set. So here we turn on, packet forwarding for IPv6, and then we run Parasite 6, and we see it sees IPv6 traffic, and so how does it see it? Well, it actually asked for it. It started the neighbor solicitation interceptor and spoofs out these packets as it sees other traffic. It says, yep, I'm also here. Send your traffic through me. It's an easy way to become in the middle of everything. Link local IPv6. Our IPv6 router advertisement. Maybe we want to not man in the middle two devices on the IPv6 network, but things leaving the network. So we just have to deal with router solicitation messages. This is again all based on the auto discovery stuff when it's IPv6. So Node would normally discover its router with a router solicitation message. I'm trying to leave the network. Where's my router? Is what it's asking. The router usually responds with the configuration details. And then, of course, as an attacker, we can say, you know what? We are a router too, but we happen to be higher priority than your previous router. Okay? The idea, again, is we man in the middle of things leaving the network. All right. So we could use just the built-in routing capabilities of Linux and the router daemon and be able to do this. So first we have our IPv6 forwarding turned on. Here we add a legitimate one to send our traffic out. And then we use the router advertisement daemon and configure it to send out the advertisement, set a high presence, send it out commonly, and send it out for this specific broadcast range. And RADVD, we'll do our router announcements directing people straight to us. Now, if we wanted to attack an IPv6 endpoint across the network, we would have to have support the whole way. If we are unable to talk to a web server, for example, that does IPv6 because we are on an IPv4 connection, we could use a few tunnels. Hurricane Electric and a few other ISPs have free IPv4 to IPv6 tunneling. You can use Teredo on Windows, and we have Meredo on Linux. We turn that on, and now we send our traffic somewhere, and it translates it to IPv6 for us. The Meredo, by default on Kali, for example, you turn it on, it'll actually come out from a machine in Italy, if I remember correctly, is where the IPv6 begins. And it sends IPv4 to that endpoint just to work around not being able to do IPv4 at some link between you and the destination. So as we said before, we can't scan with a broadcast to get addresses, but we can enumerate other ways. My typical way is to try to do broadcast for IPv4 or go from IPv4 names and look at, see what the equivalent IPv6 would be. Okay. We can enumerate DNS to do that. We might also know information about how that environment is configured from, you know, maybe some side effects and other information we've collected. Like we might see hard-coded commented out comments in HTML or something of a website as a target from testing purposes, still left as disabled but still included. Also note, it's nice to look for IPv6 addresses as we compromise. We might find lateral movement much easier because, again, those firewall rules are generally set up with IPv4 only. On the bottom of 170 here, we have a dig command that, depending upon your DNS support, is looking specifically for IPv6 address records for google.com. The N and 4As represents IPv6 style response. That's what I'm asking for when I do that kind of a command. Now I can guess, or I could use some automation to try and identify that for me as well. Now, maybe tools that don't support IPv6, or more commonly, I'm finding it's not really the tool, it's a configuration, like only IPv4 is getting routed, or only IPv4 is being bridged, or some proxy, or some piece to the puzzle just assumes IPv4. So I might find a situation where the defense does that, and I would want to speak IPv6 to work around it. This first NetSH command that we have here is a very interesting. It's basically listening on TCP port 8080 on the address and mapping things out to the address that's under connect address. And again, it's listening on IPv4 and mapping it out to IPv6. We just conveniently named it V4 to V6, not just changing the ports, but changing the destination IP. The SOCAT tool is a very powerful utility that's like Netcat, but it's highly programmable. We can do a lot of powerful things with SOCAT. The syntax is a little confusing sometimes because it is so much more featureful. But this example, we're listening on port 8080, reusing our address, starting a new connection with TCP version 6 to another IP address. And it's another way to rewrite IPv4 to IPv6 and back. This example here, this older NICTO only has an IPv4 address and only uses IPv4, so we use its host command line option to connect to port 80. And, you know, could I actually talk to it with version 6? Well, actually has been updated to version 6. Just this version isn't. This is just a good example of sometimes, again, it's more convenient to talk to something in a different protocol. There's less hoops to jump through, less circumventing the rules, and we can work more directly sometimes. If we use a tunnel, then the command at least can be more specifically simpler, like IPv4. Okay. With that, we're going to do an exercise. Our IPv6 exercise is basically a example of dealing with either a firewall or a service that only works with IPv4, and it's just going to force us to look at IPv6 addressing. So the context here is, let's say you're scanning the network as part of an assessment, and notice that 10.10.10.70 is an interesting target, and FC00660.0146 is there, but it's not the same. The ports are different, and this would be something you would see as you scanned it. Continue on with the scanning idea. You see that there is a service with a banner on it, and notice that it's exploitable. This is a JW Poppy, as in Josh Wright's initials, but it's like a mail server. It's a special Python mail server. JW Pop for mail, PY for Python. So with JW Poppy, it's again a contrived target. So you won't find this in the wild, I would think, but it's a good thought process to go through, identify something, and see if you can get around an IPv4 related limitation. This particular one we'll be using has a user of e-jobs, and that's all you've got to start with, basically. You could extract out this tarball to look at what it has and interact with it by hand and try to see if you can deal with going from IPv4 to V6. Okay? So as usual, I'm going to stop here, give you a chance to do the exercise on your own. You can flip back to lecture and look at some of the examples in syntax and some of the examples in concept and try to see how you can use what you've got on your Kali VM to attack that JW Poppy. You must be connected to our lab environment for this to work. The JW Poppy server needs to be reachable. Good luck. So I'm going to walk through the solution on our IPv6 attack exercise. Again, try to really want to encourage you to experiment on your own. It's the easiest way to learn not just what we have in the exercise, but a lot of other value-added things. I'm going to demonstrate it. You can read along in your slides if you like, on your own. So here I have my attack machine. We're going to start looking at the IPv6 settings and see what we have to work with. So I can see this is my same machine. That's my IPv4 address. I see two IPv6 addresses. The first one's our link local address. That's, not routable. And then we have this other address where it's globally unique. See the word global here? Now, I didn't manually set that on Kali as the author, or you didn't set it on yours, and you will have one as well if you're connected to our lab environment. This IPv6 address was given to us by a router on the network. It's told us that we are part of the 660 network. So let's look to see what else we can see. What I'm going to do is use a ping command to look at other machines that are on the same network. So what I'm going to do here is ping, and I need to use my address here. I'm pinging using that as my interface, the capital I, and then saying a count of three, but look for anything that's basically, local to my ETH0. Let's see what we get. I don't want to see the actual answers, but I should see new hosts pop up. So I can see a lot of 660s. I don't see everything because it's not a lot of people on the network at the moment. But I can see that, I can actually ping out and enumerate some different possibilities. And keep in mind, we were saying we might find these from, DNS records. Like we use Fierce DNS to, brute force through DNS names and find some, discover some IPv6 addresses. Or there's some other way you might encounter that. But at this point now, we've actually identified that there are some out there. And of course, I did even ping myself, right? I'm part of the network, so that's why I see duplicates, because I'm part of that network and I'm replying. And context here is that we were also looking for a vulnerable machine. Here I'm going to run a normal IPv4 scan and show you the ports that are listing on only IPv4 so that we can compare it to the IPv6 results. And here we see you have three TCP ports open at the moment, right? Port 22, 80, and 443. So far, it's not an interesting target as far as attack surface and manipulating IPv6 versus IPv4. But if we had a clue from DNS, we might be further enticed. Or we had an IPv6 scan, we might notice a port difference. With this command, ip6nay, I'll be able to see what it's already in its cache, basically. You can see it actually says stale, hasn't seen it for a while, and we see some things of interest. Again, our FE80s are link locals, and these are other machines participating in that network. Here, this one actually says router, right? So that is one thing that should draw your attention that you can drill into. We do see it's also link local, although I probably wouldn't do this first. I'd be more interested with the shorthand version of this address being, :1. It's the router for our 660 network. I'm more curious on that one because it is more obviously part of the route. So that's one thing we could look at. So an easy thing for me to do now is to do an Nmap scan. I'll do the same thing I did before, a version scan, but this time I will look for version 6 against this address and wait a moment as it scans. So that scan completed, took a moment, but after scanning that, it sees there's port 22, there's a port 110. If we go back and compare the results of port 22 on 10.10.10.70, and this line is going to be identical because it is the same machine. But this 110 service wasn't there before. And Nmap says it's unrecognized. It has data, but it's got all this other stuff, those keywords. So if you want to, if you know what it is, you can submit this fingerprint to the Nmap project and they'll include it in the next signature batch. So we see that those are there. So that is why we're targeting this particular application. It's an anomaly to us. We saw it was open. We maybe do some Googling around and we see that this JW Popper is a vulnerability in its authentication, and that's why we come down to this vulnerability. So if we look, so now that I found that JW Popper service, I want to take advantage of that. I Googled around, found this exploit. That's, again, part of our scenario. We've already provided it to you in the lab day one directory. So let's extract it and see what we have. I've extracted it. I'm going to go into this directory. I'm going to look at that README file. And it kind of explains a little bit. It says this server is whack. I guess that's a diagnosis. There is a vulnerability to be exploited. A furious number of interlaced user and no-op operations, triggering a race condition. Successful exploitation gives you access to the target account without the password. All right, sounds like a good thing. It says exploit with JW Poppy, server, port, and username. Well, we already said the scenario context. We wanted to use ejobs as the username. So let's do this. We can't get to it with IPv4. We have to get to it with that IPv6 address, though. So let's see what I still have in my clipboard. There's the address. Cool. So I can try to run JW Poppy address and username. I have to compile it. There's the IP address, the username. And I compiled it without giving it a file name destination. So it's actually a.out instead of JW Poppy. And now it's complaining that I left out the port. We add in the port. Error, no such host. What's happening is it actually detects that as a host name because it didn't recognize it as an IP address. It's trying to use it as a DNS name, basically. So this is why we have to try to work around this. We can use one of those tools like the NetSH tunnel was in the lecture example. But of course, we're on Linux. So how can we get around this? We can use that SOCAT tool and get around the limitation. Now that I have the SOCAT tunnel established, I can interact with the IPv4 end of the tunnel, which will rewrite it to our appropriate IPv6. So instead of that address, which the tool is unaware of, thinking it's a host name, I need to look at my 127.0.0.1 port 110 going to that IPv6 address of ejobs. And because it's a race condition, this may take a little bit, according to the README. So the exploit is sending out the list, getting all the email, and we get a payout of our attack, Josh's candied pecans recipe. So we can go through and parse through that HTML and read on what that is. So anyway, we've proven the point. We're able to read email and taking advantage of IPv6, which normally wouldn't have been detected. Maybe it was detected, but not exploitable by a previous assessment in that there was not a tool that was available to interact directly with it. We had to get a little creative. We had to find a way using a IPv4 to IPv6, since the exploit itself did not work raw IPv4. It was firewalled off from IPv4. We had to switch to IPv6 and the attack wouldn't work. So we had to get around that. Great workaround example. And that brings us to the end of the exercise for IPv6. Again, depending upon several situations, there may be other complications. There's enough multicasts and broadcasts that you may see other things going wrong. Do your best to run a Wireshark if you're curious of why you would know to see that IPv6 address or see what ones are available to you. Run Wireshark and or TCPdump and look at that. You'll be able to see a lot of things going on. Next, we'll talk about exploiting the network. We'll cover a few more of the things we can do with the transport layer and up. And we'll also talk about further manipulating the network a little bit more with some SNMP-related attacks, like reconfiguring the routers and switches and whatnot. And then I will describe the bootcamp and also walk through the solutions of all these exercises. So let's review where we're at so far. We attacked and got around issues with the captive portal to gain access to the network. We got that taken care of. And then we did man-in-the-middle attacks in various different ways. Let's continue on that, but looking at network infrastructure. We did the router things, too, to become in the middle. But let's look at other things that are very much related to where we've left off. I like to look at software updates. Software updates are a great opportunity for an attack. There's so many different packages that install with different updates, you know, the QuickTime and many other ones out there, third-party utilities. There's, of course, Windows updates, which are becoming simpler in mechanism to hijack as Microsoft has moved to an HTTP-based download mechanism and avoiding some of the bits-related traffic they used to use. Interesting times, as they say, on the update attack surface. But mostly we're going to take advantage of opportunities presented when third-party software packages have their own update mechanisms. They're often incomplete as far as security checks, and there's just such a variety of different applications and different updates. There's more of an opportunity for us to find one that is not correctly managed. Here is a very simple screenshot from one trying to grab something from SourceForge. For many years, anytime I saw SourceForge used for an update package, I would immediately zero in on that. SourceForge refused to use HTTPS connections until recently, here in 2019, did they finally start using HTTPS. That doesn't mean it's safe, necessarily. It's just harder to man in the middle. We'll still talk about some HTTPS-related things as well. But that is one of the things that might protect an update. The tool that's the best in class to represent upgrade attacks for third-party utilities is EvilGrade. EvilGrade is an exploit framework that comes bundled with modules that support spoofing updates for various third-party software packages. The idea is that if a victim is going to let their auto-update mechanism or the manual update mechanism happen, that the attacker could provide a malicious update. Here is your meterpreter, which looks a lot like a version of, you know, your updated software. You don't have to deliver meterpreter. It could be any executable of your choice. I believe the default was like a Korean notepad or calculator, I forget which, that comes with the framework. We can deliver meterpreter or some other payload as we like. It has built-in support for older applications. It's not maintained every, you know, regularly with newer updates, but it does have some great highlights inside of there. The Java runtime environment, WinZip, Notepad++, is what most of our screenshots come from. I've used this tool with Download Accelerator Plus in the past. There's many other opportunities as well. We still have to be in the middle from another tool, like using EtherCap, for example, or we have some other way, maybe even a phishing attack, to get ourselves in the middle, and then we can manage it with the Perl text console interface. It's a little messy because, again, of maintenance issues. It hasn't been maintained very thoroughly, and I think the last update was a few years ago. You could use it for a production penetration test. You would need to add in a module for whatever application it is you're going to exploit, after you reverse engineer how it's doing the update. The mechanism goes a little like this. First, you're going to need to deal with getting it to you, the attacker. So the easiest way to do that is usually to man in the middle the DNS portion of it looking up the host. Yes, we could man the middle, the web traffic itself, but it's easier to redirect DNS before it actually tries to get to the destination. So here we're creating a DNS entry, an address entry for notepad-plus.sourceforge.net, because that's the one that we're interested in targeting. We point it to our attacking IP address, 10.10.10.10 in this case. We add it to the Etercap DNS file so that the Etercap DNS spoof uses that as a destination. Then we can run Etercap, do our classic ARP poisoning, and we could specify on the command line a minus P for a plugin, or you can interactively hit P for the plugins and type in DNS spoof to activate that plugin. At that point, if the upgrade happens, the upgrade request happens, it's going to pass through Etercap and get our malicious one, but we haven't set up our malicious payload yet. There's a couple of ways we could do this. If you use the default evil grade agent, you can just use it as is. But I like to use MSF Venom directly, or I even use the Trusted Security's Magic Unicorn. It's a Python script that wraps around MSF Venom. We talk about it more in 660.2, but it's just a little easier to type than this long MSF Venom command. But the resulting agent.exe that we have in the second command line of this slide is going to give us an interpreter delivered as a fake update to the victim. And then we need to have a place for this interpreter to connect to, right? So we use MSF console, minus X is the command it's going to execute, exploit multi-handler, set the payload to reverse on the port and just keep running it. And now we're ready to receive the connection. We still need the actual URL mechanism though that the update will connect to get its download. So we provide that via our evil grade engine. It's already written into the engine, it's an existing module. We run evil grade, we configure the option for Notepad Plus. Show options will of course list what we have. You could change the destination of the agent file name. And if you want to really read this up, you could look at the Perl module that this is written as and follow it along fairly easily. One of the reasons Evil Grade isn't maintained is because of some Perl changes to hosting. There's a bit of a race condition, and you might get a zero byte size download if you try this on your own. I have better success if I go back to an earlier vintage of Kali that has an earlier version of the Perl libraries that Evil Grade needs, and it tends to work a little better. But you could, if you wanted to, start that up and do the update and try it out. It would look a little like what we see here on the Notepad++ update attack. Here we see either the periodic auto update or manually going in by clicking on the question mark menu item. You can select update. And what's going to happen is it's going to go out, make a web request, see the evil grade is telling it, yes, in fact, there is an update. You need an update. And then we get this dialogue as the victim. An update package is available. Do you want to download it? And of course, we're hoping the victim says yes, expecting that they will eventually download the update. Evil Grade will log every request and response and also always answer that there's always an update and provide that evil interpreter as that update in whatever file format. And maybe there's a exchange of serial numbers and other checks that the web server is supposed to do. And Evil Grade will handle all of that for us to better mimic the real life update site. Once the interpreter runs, we could, of course, get something more interesting out of it. Run a shell, steal some passwords, whatever we're going to do. All right? But all of this is possible because of the update mechanism from a third-party software is not properly validating that download is what it thought it was, assuming that it was able to get a legitimate download and executing it. What makes this even more valuable to an attacker is if this program is installed in somewhere like program files, in order to update that executable, it has to write to that directory, which means has to be running as administrator, which means, again, your meterpreter is already running as administrator when it runs. It has to do that to save the executable in a non-malicious way. If it's doing an update, it must run as admin. So it's even more attractive for those reasons. All right, so you can use maybe using Core Impact, you have one of those agents, or you have a Covenant and you put in a Grunt or a Empire Stager or whatever this would be as far as a attacker-based malware. We could do lots of great things. You could do it a little bit more benign and have it print out a hello world message or just only log something so that it doesn't give an actual payload execution possibility, but that is still logged in some way where you can go find out, gee, who's got the old software still installed. Of course, you can customize it as much as you like, test locally, utilize it in your test. I will also say that another reason we don't tend to use EvilGrate as much in as much as we used to years ago is that we can do all these things with EtterCap, BetterCap, and other tools. You just have to write the appropriate filter or plugin that replaces that executable with the one you would like them to run. EvilGrate just was nice because it also mimicked the upgrade website in case you would have a way to log in by hand to get the update, or if there was an exchange of serial numbers, it could handle that. Instead of doing multiple complex filtering, you could recycle some of that code.